now tuned into the Meds, Drinks, and Chill podcast. Follow us at Meds, Drinks, and Chill on Instagram. Yo, what's going on? It's another episode of Meds, Drinks, and Chill. Hope everybody doing all right out here. Today's topic is mental health, and I got a guest with me today. Kia, what's going on?
What's going on? Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming through. How's everything going?
Going great out here, saving one life at a time, you know.
How long you been doing this?
So, matter of fact,
tell them what you're doing.
Okay, good stuff. Yeah. So I'm a licensed professional counselor. I've been in the mental health field since about 2010. Uh-huh. I graduated with my master's in 2015 and have done all type of counseling, ranging from school-based therapy to drug and alcohol treatment, adult outpatient counseling, and currently do telephonic mental health counseling.
Which one's your favorite? Like, if you have to stick in a field, or is it all...
Kids.
Kids, really?
Kids. Kids are the future. We have to protect them and groom them while they're young so that we have successful and loved adults, functioning adults.
That makes sense, because when they're young, you can still kind of... you know, mold them and groom them into. So I ain't gonna say it's a lost cause, but the older they get, it's harder for somebody to change, basically?
I will agree with that statement 110%.
Really?
I think there was a point in my career where I was working with adults and felt like I kind of knew what was gonna happen before it happened. So I got drained very quickly. Like, oh, I know this is gonna happen.
So,
one thing with adults, there's anniversaries, there's birthdays. So those things always come back around. So you always feel like you're starting from scratch when those anniversaries come back around.
Like, what do you mean? Like, anniversaries is.
Anniversaries of death, anniversaries of maybe possible suicide attempts, anniversaries of any major life event that has occurred.
Yeah.
More specifically with adults, if they have injuries or something like that has happened or they became disabled, they'll go back to that time. That disability may have put them out of work. So once that anniversary of those events come back around, people usually start from scratch.
That's crazy. I never even thought about that. Like, so, almost like a relapse in a sense, or
emotional relapse. Yeah,
that's crazy. I never think about stuff like that. How important is it to be like fully aware of what's going on, like mentally, of yourself? Like,
I think it's challenging because when we're not taught about our emotions,
exactly,
and I think that it's a just like you're taught how to have, let's say. You go to school, right? Do your schoolwork, do that. Or everyone, you're always taught to be happy, but you're not taught how to deal with anger or different emotions like that.
Yeah.
So I think it's hard when you never practice taking self-inventory. You know, parents, we don't teach our children that.
Like,
check in with yourself, you know what I mean? Take care of yourself, be gentle with yourself. Usually it's like, you know, get out of it, keep it moving, and, you know, go on with your day.
And so, like, you get so wrapped up in life, it's kind of hard. Like, of course, we go to the gym, we do everything else, but we never really take care of our mental health.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you say that. One thing I tell patients that I work with is, if you go to the doctor's office, you don't go there saying that your leg is broke when it's your arm. So with a therapist, you have to be very direct on what you're telling us because we can't work or address something that we don't know that's going on. So if you wouldn't tell a doctor that you're, you know, something's broke that ain't broke, don't do that, you know, in counseling and really when you're focusing on your mental health.
I would think people would be like, you know, there's a stigma behind, like, going to check for, you know, saying I feel some type of way, like, emotionally, like, especially for men. Like, I know it's a lot hard. Like, for me, I don't think I'd ever be, I just deal with stuff when things happen, but I'll deal with it by myself. And I never really check in on, like, mentally where I am. I just keep it moving.
It's interesting that you say that. One thing when dealing with male clients, whether it be, and we see it, of course, in the African-American, or I should say the brown, you know, culture, because especially also in the Hispanic community as well, males in that population, you're taught to not, you know, address that. But my response to that, I have a response to everything when it comes to positivity related to mental health, is that if if you're allowed to show happiness and it's an emotion, you're allowed to show sadness.
You know, I was definitely not taught that. Like.
Right. But it's like it's okay to be happy, but it's not okay to be sad. You know, so I always look at it like that. And again, it's important to be gentle with yourself and know, like, this needs to be taken care of. And I'm human. It's not male, female. It's being a human being and having emotions.
But that's just how we were raised, especially as black men. And I'm African, so we definitely did. like showing emotion and bitching and complaining. I was like, you leave that to the women, bro.
Right.
Like, we just went, I don't know. That's crazy. But so there is like a negative, I don't know, like stigma towards, you know, being emotional.
I believe so. I believe because it's taught. Just yeah. And I think they say, or there's a saying that we start treating our children their gender when they're in the womb. So it's like, oh, this little girl, we're going to take care of her. We're going to put bows on her. And then when it's a boy, we're like, oh, we're going to just do this. And he's going to play football. He's going to do this. Yeah. So we start, you know, giving you those attributes from the womb. And then you're groomed that way as soon as, you know, you're born. You know, so I think that it's. And we're in, I think, a current culture that is very sensitive to when you start identifying gender roles and different things like that.
Especially now.
Right, right. But I mean, we can't undo what has we've been doing for years as black and brown people in our culture. And I think now having access to the things we didn't have access to before is where we kind of shift the, I don't know if paradigm would be the correct words, or just kind of shift how you're dealing with your future children or your lineage.
Yeah, see, because as a kid, I'm like, man up. As a little boy, I was always told to man up. Mm-hmm. But you don't really tell that to a little girl. You just be like, oh, she's just a girl. Like,
right.
Do you think there's a difference between, like, is it therapizing? Is that what it's called? Like, when you're therapizing, or what's the word?
Therapy.
No, but there has to be a word. Like
counseling.
Counseling? Yeah, all right, so between a black person and a white person, like, does it seem like, like, not trying to be funny, but white people deal with less stressful things than they complain about than... Or is that something you can't even talk about?
No, I can talk about whatever I want to talk about. You know, I think that I personally can only speak to my experience and my cultural experience, you know? But the thing that is similar, I always tell people, again, here's one of my things, right? We're more alike than we are unalike. So the same thing that that's you feel like... Oh man, this is hard. I'm dealing with this, you know. And something I find myself saying more frequently to my patients is that, like, you have your experience, I have 200 plus experiences. So it's up to you to trust me to help you work through this, because I've seen it, you know, and I've seen the other side of it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where you, or where I have gained that security and that trust with patients and letting them know, like, okay, I've seen, you know, the other side of this, or where the grass gets a little greener. But I think related to race, because our stressors are different, you know? And I think that's, you could just see that with,
the things they complain about, or I guess, or
Or things that we probably don't feel like are a big idea. But I think that can go even further to not think of black and white, but like, culture-wise, so here in America, we're like depression and this and that and anxiety and this, where you have other countries where, what is depression? We don't know what that is. We don't have food. Yeah. We don't have time to be depressed.
Right.
So I think it goes even beyond the scope of black and white. But I think sometimes, of course, to be real about it, right, they gonna complain about some stuff that we're like, all right, it ain't that big of a deal.
Right.
Or we just don't understand because our struggles are different.
Yeah, that makes sense. Self-medication, like, is it a normal thing to self-medicate? Like, because anytime I feel down or something, I will self-medicate. Like, and I know that's a bad thing to do. It's best for you to just really go get some help. But it just seems like the easier thing to do. Some people don't have 200. How much? It's a lot of money to go get some therapy, right?
I'm glad that you touched on that. Yeah, so when we look at the dynamics in therapy and why maybe people that are less poverty, if we shift from like black and white and look at poverty and social class, absolutely. Like, if this is the perfect time to start playing like All About the Benjamins, because that's really, you know, what it is. I think to do an intake session, and that consists of kind of gathering background information and gathering a person's history, that could be $150 for an hour that you're paying. If you don't have insurance, you know, you have to pay that out of pocket. Back in a job that I worked before, and seeing kind of looking back at insurance, there are people that they might need medical insurance, but Medicaid, they'll go the route of getting mental health benefits first. So they're in, you know, offices, outpatient offices, getting diagnosed with maybe depression or anxiety. But that kind of gives them the ticket into the door of Medicaid benefits. So it's it's definitely a monetary thing as well.
Do you believe in medicine? Like, do you? That's where I was like prescription medicine, like legal medicine.
Every therapist, maybe, I'm not going to say every therapist, that was a broad statement. I think a good amount of people believe that medication is not monotherapy, meaning I'm not going to give you a pill and it's going to work right off the back. So you have to do other things to kind of really work with that medication. The medication does not start and it doesn't kick in, you know, as soon as it hits your tongue. So that's when we get into coping skills. That's when we get into counseling. So what coping skills do is it allows you to have a resource to practice something in the moment. Some people think that coloring is so extreme. Like, oh, I'm an adult, I'm not going to color. It's so therapeutic. Or coloring? Coloring.
Because you said that right now, and it sounds so crazy.
It sounds crazy.
I haven't colored since I was a kid.
Yes, but think of, like, colors, right? The excitement, that bright blues, yellow, pink, that all that's, like, linked to your emotions and your energy. That's why we get happy when the sun is shining. You know what I mean? Yeah. So you have to be really mindful of things like that. That, like you said, we're adults. We're like, I ain't got time to color. Like, what are you talking about? A big one is journaling. People are like, what? I've got a journal. Or somebody's going to read my journal. What I tell people is write in that journal, get it out your head, because what happens is, we all know what happens. Oh, I done told this friend this whole time. I'm tired of talking to them. I ain't got nobody to speak with. And journaling is therapeutic because it gets it out of your head. People are staying up having these thoughts, ruminating, you know, averaging 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night, thinking about whatever that burden is that they're carrying. So journaling, I say, is always a good resource, a good outlet, a good coping skill. But to answer your question, I do feel that medication works. You have to find your right regimen of medication, because people respond differently to medications.
Like side effects, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Side effects can be extreme depending on a person's diagnosis. For example, not to get like too deep, but like, let's say a person that may be diagnosed with bipolar, that's a good one to touch on, because everybody thinks somebody's bipolar, like, oh, they done switched up in 2 seconds. There's way more criteria that goes into, you know, being bipolar, but that person may not be able to take an antidepressant, because that may force them basically, or put them into like a manic state where they're engaging in risky and dangerous behaviors.
Like manic depression?
So manic being, so there's the manic depressive or depression, but manic state of maybe like engaging in risky behaviors or doing things or cashing out your whole bank account or getting in arguments with random people. So it's a whole extreme where it makes it more fatal because this person may have taken a medication that just did not work for them and put them in that state. So medication works when it's done correctly and definitely monitored.
Now, so you know how like a barber cuts hair, right? So he can spot a bad shape up from a mile away. Like when you're talking to the average person, can you pick up on certain things like mental issues? Like,
it's so funny because whenever I tell people what I do for a living, they're like, are you doing counseling on me? Are you reading my mind? I'm like, are you paying me? Like, no, I don't.
But it's a natural thing though. Like,
It is. Yeah. You learn about people very, very quickly. I think it's a gift and a curse, because sometimes you're like, man, this person, this person teetering on the edge or something. But, I think that, sometimes you can.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can. And I think, especially those people that don't know how to stop talking when they start, you'd be like, oh, they got something on their mind that, you know, they want to get off. So I think, that's a good analogy. But, if you're a good therapist, you know, you can spot it. But you definitely have to be passionate about your work.
And I'm sure some people, when they figure out what you do, they're like, well, let me see if I get some free free therapy from her.
Absolutely. I have a cousin that she'll be like, listen, I know that you do this for a living. I just got a question to ask you really quick. And like, she respects that, because it's so easy for us to be like, let me call her and get this, you know, let me talk to her. But then on the opposite side, who checks in on you?
You know
what I mean? It's very seldom. People are like, well, how are you doing? You know, on an average day, I may talk to, I'll say, 30 to 40 people any given day. And every person I talk to is suicidal.
Really?
So literally, I'm talking to someone every single day, all day.
That has to take a toll on you.
It does, but it doesn't. And some people think I'm crazy. I'm like, it doesn't. You can't feel guilty for other people's situation. You know, like, we all have our history, our past. We all have made it through some stuff. So if you start taking on everybody's situation, you know what I mean?
It's so, like, you can literally leave your work at home and go home and live your day?
And go on.
Really?
Yeah, and it's real. And you'd That's be surprised. Dope. Yeah, like, the littlest things might, like, you know, hold on to you. Yeah. But, like, you, most of the day, I say in, like, a 7-day work week, I come home. For the most part, 7 days, like... Okay.
Wait, you work a 7-day work week?
I'm sorry. Oh, my goodness. No, I didn't mean seven.
I was
5 days.
Say, you need a break. Five,
yeah, no, no. Yeah, I'll be like, have like burnout, yeah. And then that's a whole other situation. But no, like in a work week, it's like I can really go home and be like, okay. You know, and I think I've been in the mental health field for, I would say, going on 10 years. And you experience suicide. It's a part of mental health. I can say, it sounds a little extreme, I've had two people that I've known or worked with, not in a therapy setting, but like in a case management setting, that successfully committed it. And things like you and I were saying, we might not think that's major, but to them, it was something so severe. The reason that they did it.
Oh, the reason that they did it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. No, the act is definitely major, but their motivation behind it, you're like, what?
That happens a lot. Like, you'll hear about somebody that killed him. You're like, you killed yourself over that? But that's really insensitive because you don't know, right?
Yep.
Can you speak on that? Like, when like, people are very insensitive or they don't understand suicide, like, they think, like, you can't, it'd be the minor issue to us, but to them it could be something heavy.
I think that another thing, again, I have all these things, right, that I try and instill in people.
Right.
Sometimes, and this is a great example, I've worked with patients that made over $100,000 a year, and then they end up, let's say, with a broken leg where they can't work their job anymore, or a major injury where they can't work their job no more.
Right.
So when we look at that person's story, they were making $100,000. They're out of work. You know, work's only going to compensate you for so long.
Right.
Now the next step is to apply for disability. I don't know if you know about Social Security disability. It takes 2, 3, 4 years to get in the process. Yeah. And they're denying you in the process, right? So you're already waiting for that hearing for, let's say, 6 months. Even for the hearing, that's not a determination.
Yeah.
So all this time, you don't have money. You're going through your savings.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Then if you're awarded it, right, now you're back on all your bills. Another thing we talked about, Medicaid. With Medicaid before in Pennsylvania, I can't speak to here in North Carolina, but you couldn't have more than $2,000 in your bank account.
What?
So, listen, these are the extreme dynamics, you know? You can't have more than $2,000 in your bank account to receive these benefits. But if you've been applying for, let's say, Social Security disability for the last 2 or 3 years, they end up retroing you that money. So now you lose. Now you got, let's say, $30,000, right? Because they didn't pay you all those months that you applied.
Right.
Now you lose your Medicaid, which is your insurance to survive all these elements that you have, because now you have more than $2,000 in your bank account.
Wow.
I know people,
what the fuck?
Yes. So these people.
What type of system is this?
Exactly. Exactly. So then these people end up spending down $20,000, $30,000 so that they can get this Medicaid, because they need their medication, whether it be mental health medication, physical health medication. And this is like the more broader picture of how, like, I'm very sensitive to depression, because it could be any of us. It could be you. It could be I. As soon as that one injury happens, and then, like, our livelihood has changed.
Right.
What do you think I'm going to be?
How could you be in a good mood?
Exactly. Exactly. So that is just, like, literally the stretch of it. I've had everything and now I've lost it. Yeah, I'm going to be depressed. What does better look like when I had it all, when I had houses and cars and money and vacations? What does better look like? What's the other side of that? So I always tell people, like, it might seem long term, because waiting for that disability is a long time, you know?
A couple of years is a long time.
Right, exactly. And trying to just borrow from friends and do this and pay, you know, and, like, what is it, like, take from Peter to pay Paul and things like that. So when you look at depression more specifically, that's one case I can say that is really extreme, but that I've seen is common. You go from having everything to go to having nothing. And now what do I do? So
that shit can happen to anybody, basically.
Anybody.
Yeah.
Because we're just regular, you know, working citizens of this good old America. And
shit could change instantly. That's
instantly.
Crazy.
Instantly. Mm-hmm. And things out of your control.
How important is alone time? Because there's a difference between isolation and me time. Mm-hmm. So how important do you think is me time for people? Like,
I think it's it's important. You need to, and I think that's one thing that that is important to touch on is, you know, that me time, starting your day, ending your day, really focusing on yourself and the things that you introduce yourself to in the morning, whether it be motivational, you know, speaking, or, you know, if you're into spirituality, tapping into that. Sometimes you can't start your day off with hardcore rap music and that's not the energy that you're feeling, or, you know, your spirit ain't like that. Exactly. So I think how you start and end your day is really important. But definitely taking time to reflect, learn yourself, learn how to, again, I love the word, just being gentle with yourself, being kind to yourself, your mind, your body, and different things like that. It's absolutely important to spend some time with yourself and learn who you are, because you can't, you know, expect things from other people or expect people to treat you a certain way when you have not fully learned yourself.
Yeah. Me time is very important. A lot of people don't understand, like, and that doesn't mean you could just be sitting in a room alone. Like, I love just sitting around doing nothing. Like, it gets you, it leaves you time with your thoughts just to set free. You can do whatever you want. I mean,
it's the most productive, unproductive thing
it
ever.
It really is. Say that again, because that is real. It's the most productive,
unproductive thing you can do is have some me time and be left with your thoughts.
You need to put that on a shirt. Straight up. We might have to edit that part out. All right, so with kids, you said you enjoyed that part the most, as far as, because basically you can kind of groom them and there's more hope for them in a sense.
Yeah, you know what? To be honest, thinking about children, like I said, the adults I start knowing, and I was like, okay, this person gonna go through this, and this is gonna happen.
Yeah.
But with kids, it was the best and then the worst, because what I found out with working with the kids that I worked with, I started seeing a lot of multifamily households. And with that dynamic, the kid that I was getting was the kid that was missed, or they were the kid that needed the attention.
Like, so, a middle child or something like that?
Yeah, middle child. But these are like, I can say my last year working with children, I was doing a lot of six family households. So it's like you was the middle times two, and you had people under you, over you, you know what I mean?
Things I was like the middle that. Child. Like, really? I'm the second out of four, and I was the only boy.
Right.
So I pretty much did my own thing. I was always a loner.
Right. Yeah. But you know what they say about the dynamics of the sibling, I guess, would it be lineup or a sibling, like, you know, I guess it would be position, like the oldest child is always the one that's almost like the parental role.
Right.
Taking the,
that's,
you know,
exactly,
taking
how my
the
oldest
charge.
Sister was.
Yeah. Taking charge, handling things, making sure the other, you know, the other kids are straight. And then the middle child is, I think it depends on the dynamics, right?
All right. So my sister that came right after me, she's a year and some change. Like, so she came right. So, and she's the baby. She was the baby for a while.
Right.
So she pretty much got most of the attention. Mm-hmm. So I had an older sister who was the parental. And then the one who's like right underneath me was like a year and some change. And then the other one came like 10 years later. So there's a big gap with that too.
Right. I think in your situation, it's special because you're the only boy. But like, I would think, and I don't want to be like, this is how it really going to be or go down. But I can imagine if it was a girl in that lineup as the middle child, it's like, where do I fall? You know, and like, look at it like, freshman, sophomore, junior, high school year.
Okay.
Freshman year, you're the newbie. You're like, woo, all the attention's on me. I'm just learning this. People are going to pay attention to me. They're going to help me get around the school. Then junior and sophomore year, it's like, whatever. I'm leaving next year. Yeah. And then, you know, sophomore year is like, I got two more years here. And then the senior year is like, I'm out of here. I did. You know what I mean? So when you look at it like that, that's almost like how, like, the family makeup is. Mm-hmm. Like, the older one is like, listen, I'm almost out of here. I'm doing what I have to do. The younger one gets all the attention. And then the middle one is like, well, what about me? And what do I do next? Yeah. You know, where is my praise coming from? Because the little one, you're still celebrating, like, you know, those little moments that they're learning or experiencing. And the older one is just like, listen, I'm tapped out. Exactly. Like, you know, or they might be the kid, the first one to graduate. So then they get all the accolades and the praise. Mm-hmm. So the middle child kind of is like, well, where do I fit in? Yeah. You know what I mean? So I think that sometimes it can look like that, or the perception can be like that, or the feeling can be like that. Mm-hmm. I'm the youngest, only girl of three brothers, so that's a whole other, you know?
So you were spoiled in a sense, or they overprotective of you?
Yeah, I would say a little bit of both. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, a little bit of both. And, you know, thank God I have a dad who's, you know, a present dad. Yeah. So it's like all that energy.
We need to touch on that, too.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, all that energy and, you know, love and having positive love from the male figures is, I think, so important. But again, being the baby and like, all right, I'm look out for, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like they really took care of me. So I think that dynamic in itself is, you know, a whole dynamic, you know, alone.
All right. So you touched on the father part being present. There's a lot of homes without the father. Do you see a major, like, all right, so there's, when people lose their mother, I know a lot of people who lose their mother at a young age, and they're more of like a, I'm not going to say cold-hearted or kind of like, there's just not that sense of love in a sense, like, and then when you lose your father or he's just not there, it's pretty much like a guidance issue. Like, does that affect, how much does that affect a kid, like, when you see them in therapy?
I think the bigger... We're talking about, like, if we think of absent fathers, right?
Right.
Or let's say, I think you said something about a mother passing away or how extreme that is. And then there are also parents that are missing that aren't dead. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That would probably hurt more, I would think.
Right. Because it goes into that cycle of, why am I not good enough? Or you have other kids that you're spending time with. Why are they better? And then you go searching for those answers, or you spend your whole life searching for those answers to be good enough, or you start over excelling, right? Oh, I have to show that I'm the best. I'm the best. I'm the best.
Yeah.
You're the best and you're doing great stuff. And
it's daddy like a competition.
And he still didn't come check on me. You know what I mean?
So I never even thought about that.
Yeah.
Because I would have thought, if you would have asked me, I would think the dead parent would be worse. But if they're there and they still don't give a shit, that's got to be worse.
Yeah, because you're always, depending on what type of person you are, right? So I'm just speaking from one, like, you know, perspective of that child that just is over excels.
Yeah.
And you still didn't, you know, you still didn't check on me. I still didn't do good enough. This still wasn't good enough for you. You know
Damn.
What I mean? I'm graduating the academy. I did this.
Right.
You know, I got honors. Hey, did somebody let my dad know? Does he know that I, you know,
exactly.
succeeded at this? But there is a thinking of like lineage and family, because I think it's up for debate, right? Some people are like, oh, my dad was a girl who has a dad that's not there. That's why she's promiscuous. That's why she's that. Or a guy that has a mother that's not there. That's why he treats women like shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that it depends, because you have that other aspect, right, where people are like, I'm going to do better than my mom. I'm going to do better than my dad.
Yeah.
So I think that's a tough argument or a tough debate. There's a book I'll have to look in for the name of it, but it was, I think it's called, it's something related to like, you're not your past. And basically in that book, they touch on kind of what we're talking about, the people that you need forgiveness from, that what if they passed away, and the trauma that we're dealing with that is not your trauma to deal with, but it was the generation's trauma before you.
Right.
And needing to like heal that in present day. So that kind of even cycles back to some of the things we discussed earlier, but really like what happens when you have that parent or that grandparent, that the trauma was inflicted on them and this is where it all started, but how do you confront them?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I'm a big believer on like, our parents are first learning with us. They were kids before they were parents. You
That's
know what
true.
I mean?
Very
so
true.
Sometimes it's hard to say, and people are like, I don't agree with her.
Yeah.
But like, you have to find forgiveness in your parents for the wrongs that they did, because we were literally like, you know, like almost like the project, you know, like how's this going to turn out? Am I
That's
raising this kid good? Am I not raising this kid good?
Yeah.
And it's funny. I had this conversation with my mom and I'm like, yo, it don't matter how good you raise a child at one point, I feel like in the parental child dynamic, you're not going to like your parent.
Of course.
The parent's not going to know why. They're going to be like, I done gave you everything you wanted.
Yeah.
And like, there's just that shift in, you know, the paradigm where you're like, my kid don't fuck with me and why.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's got to be the time when you just want to go out there and spread your wings and try to see like, yo, let me see if I can ride this bike by myself. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, with no training wheels. But a lot of times if you survive, which is, you always come back and realize like, yo, my parents were right the whole time.
Right. Right.
Because being first generation African and Safi, you would notice too, like, there's a lot of kids who were first generation anything.
Trial and
error. Yeah, it's trial and error. So, and a lot of them, they don't forgive their parents. They're like, yo, my parents didn't do this for me. But I'm like, my nigga, they didn't know shit. They came to this world blind. And they were pretty much trial and error trying to figure it out on their own. So, forgiveness is important. From the jump, as a kid, I already, like, I put that in my head. Like, they don't know no better, in the sense of, like, they're learning America the same way I'm learning it. And with way more responsibilities. Like, they working, trying to raise kids. It had to be rough on them. So I forgave them early. But there's, I know a lot of kids, well, they're grown now, but they still have that resentment towards their parents.
And it doesn't get better if you don't practice forgiveness.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it's so easy. Like, there's all those cliches and there's all those quotes that's like, forgiveness is for you. It's not for the other person, but it really is for you because you can carry that burden forever. Like, oh, I'm mad. Like, it's so much energy to be mad and try and like reflect in your mind and go down the list of things you pissed off about.
Yeah.
But when you practice forgiveness, you're like eased of all those burdens, those thoughts, and trying to keep tally and tabs on somebody pissed you off, so now I don't want to talk to them. And I got to remember, I don't like Auntie so-and-so and Uncle so-and-so, and my mama was on their side. Like, it's so draining, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To try and really keep a running tab of all the things or all the people that screwed you over your lifetime. Practice forgiveness, move on, free yourself from that, and then be productive. You know what I mean? That's
right.
How I look at it.
Can you subconsciously like hold a grudge and not even know that you're doing it?
Yeah, that's like when people, those statuses that be like, somebody said they beefing with me, but they beefing with themselves, or whatever those statuses are. Like,
right.
You got that beef. Yeah, you know what I mean? I definitely think that. But everything has an underlying reason for whatever it is. You
mm-hmm.
know what I mean? And it's most important to identify the source of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my background is in couples, marriage, family therapy. So all of my experience or learning, you know, background is in the family dynamics. So I'm a strong believer of how you were raised. The family dynamics is what contributes to who you are as an adult today. Good, bad, and different, right?
Right.
So I definitely think those things, again, that we hold on to or that we've been taught, right?
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes we're like, oh, this person, the family always said this about this person. And then you start carrying that myth or that whatever, you know
right,
what I mean, think
right.
about this one family member or this person.
Uh-huh.
And then it just goes on and on and on. And you never rectify that situation because you're like, well, I'm just going off what my mama told me. I'm going off what my dad told me. That's the crazy uncle. That's the crazy aunt. You
uh-huh.
know what I mean? So I think that too is, parents have to be mindful of what they're telling their children as well, because they'll hold on to that. You
right.
know what I mean? Those perceptions of those other family members, of people, and different things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We parents are the role models,
right?
You know, and it sounds so cliche, but it's real. Who I live with you 24/7,
and they're your superhero in a
mm-hmm.
sense.
Yeah.
All right. So you're probably the best person to ask about this. So with, you know, the whole thing going on with the LGBTQ community and stuff, like, being that you're a therapist, do you think people are born that way, or is it a learned behavior, especially since you deal with that kind of...
You're not really being into this one, Matt. I think it's a touchy subject.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the climate of our culture, I think it's a touchy subject.
Mm-hmm.
Because people have their own beliefs on it.
Yeah.
This is my personal opinion. It's not my professional opinion.
Okay.
But I do think, like, when there is some like sexual abuse or sexual trauma, that does have a role in some people's lives. Not everyone, because some people will say that they're born gay. Nature versus nurture. I'm
right.
not getting. That's not my battle to fight.
Right. But it's just an opinion. It ain't,
right. Exactly. Right. Yeah. 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 So I think, like, that's not a professional opinion, but my personal opinion.
Uh-huh.
I think that when people experience sexual abuse or sexual trauma, it has the potential to impact your sexual preference, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, I'm not saying this is every, you know,
right,
lesbian, trans, you know, gay.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's everyone's experience, but I do think that I'm a therapist. I have hundreds of people's, you know, experiences.
And that's what I wanted to ask you exactly.
In my mind, and I know that there are women that are like, oh no, I was sexually abused by a man. I will never. They're too aggressive. They're too this. And that's their experience. So that's why they're like, let me be with a woman. You know, somebody that's going to meet me where I'm at.
Right.
So I think that having that insight, having that knowledge, there's some of both, you know. But then
right.
looking at one thing I'm a strong believer of, and again, this is my opinion, I'm not saying it's right.
Yeah.
I don't think the amount of verbal, mental abuse, sometimes sexual abuse,
mm-hmm.
that men experience when they come out being a gay male or when they are a gay male, I don't think nobody would sign up for that. I don't think nobody would be like, let me, yay, sign me up to be abused to this capacity. Right. So I think if it was a choice, if you're signing up for that, that's a whole different, you know, I guess, experiment. But when I look at it in that way, you look how people are down and shunned. Like, in our generation, that it wasn't cool. You know what I mean? It wasn't cool. You were definitely shunned. And now we're in a generation where it's more acceptable. But thinking about, like, our generation and being in the 90s, I don't think nobody wants to, like, blame
go
like,
through that, right?
Yeah, go right. through it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, that makes sense. I think it's both. Like, I think it can be a learned behavior, and I think you could be born that way. I know some of my friends who are, like, super, like, religious, spiritual, and they do not believe that. They're like, nah, it's a spirit. You can't be born that way. And I'm like, man, why not? Like, there's, I don't want to get too deep into it, but that's just my opinion. But I just want to ask you that because you deal with so many people on that level.
I will say this, believe it or not, I uh-huh. went back to my childhood middle school, and one of the teachers there a couple years ago said the teenage or the pregnancy rate in the middle school was down because the girls start experimenting with, like, being homosexual. So
really?
The teenage pregnancy rate was down. They had less pregnancies, and this is middle school, 6th through 8th grade.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they start experimenting with their sexuality.
That makes sense numbers mm-hmm. wise, I guess. Cause, mm-hmm. yeah,
and these are kids, you know. So what's next for you?
Wow, that just blew my mind. That's crazy, right?
Puts things into perspective.
Now you said it doesn't bother. Like, I think it's really amazing that you can leave your work at home because taking in that kind of stuff and then you can just leave it there. Like, did that have anything to do with your upbringing, or is that something because you were through studying you can just. Because me, I'm kind of cold-hearted, so I can literally just see somebody get hit by a car right now, and then 20 minutes later, I'm not even thinking about them. Like,
I think it's... So, I don't know why. We was in family therapy when I was younger, and my mom said... I was 4, my brother was 6. My mom said that I told my brother... That I told this therapist...
You were in therapy
I was
as
in
a
therapy,
kid?
Yeah. Oh, wow. I don't know why I was in therapy. Maybe I need to... Got some own stuff I need to go work out, I guess. But my mom said that I told the therapist... I talk about my feelings and my brother doesn't. And we were 4 and 6. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think that really, that showed my personality as a young child.
Right.
And one thing my mom always said to us is, like, you can say whatever you want as long as you don't curse. So I don't hold back.
Right.
And I always tell people, like, I'm a good ass therapist. I'm one of the best therapists ever, but I'm a real therapist, you know? And I feel like there's ways to professionally check people, you know, when my thing is, like, I tell patients straight up from the door, I'm not going to work harder than you. This is your life you're trying to fix, not my life. So what are we going to do? You know?
Wow.
So, and that's just real. And that shows you straight like that.
Yeah.
So what do you do? And the thing is, you know that people want help even if they're not saying it because they're showing up to them appointments once a week for an hour. You know what I mean? So
right.
you want something. You just don't know how to ask for it. Or, you know, or maybe when you asked for it in the past, nobody answered your questions. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that where do we start from? Let's start from your childhood. Okay. And as soon as people start talking about their childhood, of course I'm trained, right, to pick up on things and to listen to things. And as a therapist, we listen to things that people don't even hear. You know what I mean? Or you're like, what? You got that from that? I'm like, man, listen, I'm telling you, I know.
Yeah.
So I think that looking at it in that capacity, no, I don't take it home. And again, we all have our own experiences. We all have our own story.
Right.
So it's like, if nobody ain't feeling sorry for my story, you know what I mean? Like, you can't feel sorry. How do you make it through? You know, I'm here sitting in front of you as a therapist. Something happened where I'm successful and made it through. So it's like, how do you support these people in that journey? If you focus on, you'll be stuck, and I'll be I would not be of benefit or of use to any other patient if I got stuck on one person. So I think that's how you look
at
it as
well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can get stuck in people's stuff with them.
Right.
But yeah, no. Mm-mm. Keep moving. You know, like, what we going to work on next? You come back next week to talk about this? Okay, make sure you add a little cherry on top because we're going to make this process go.
So you don't have to dig? Like, you pretty much just sit there and just...
I just listen to what people tell me, but I'm a strong believer of your process is your process. You can come to counseling and say a whole lot, or you can come to counseling and not say anything.
Mm.
So you have you have patients that, I have patients that have came to counseling and didn't say anything. And I'm like, it's your process.
Have you ever dealt with like war PTSD?
No, I haven't. I haven't. And I think it's really, it's just a sensitive one. And I think, honestly, personal confidence, I don't know much about it. You know what I mean? Yeah, I don't know much about war and like or veterans and, you know, their needs. And I, from my understanding, that population is very sensitive to make sure that they have somebody that is understanding of them. And I never just did the research. It was never really of interest of mine.
Right.
You know, every therapist has their specialty of like, you know what? I could do this off the top of my head. Yeah. That's one of those things where it's like, no, you know what I mean? And I wouldn't be a benefit to them just because it's not something I'm interested in. You know what I mean? So I wouldn't, I haven't dealt with that.
War PTSD is crazy. I mean, a lot of times, I had friends who went to Iraq and stuff, and literally when they come back, they just put them right back in population, like it's, which is so fucked up. Like even when you come home from prison, like they put you in a halfway house, slowly get you back into the society. Mm-hmm. But it seems like with war, especially with the Iraq war, I don't know, I can't speak on everyone, but you know, me and Safi got homies who they came right back into the society, like they could just go back to working a 9-to-5 if you just came back from real war.
You just had an AK.
Yeah, you were just out there really holding it down, and now you got
to. Now you got to. Shoot this lead out this big pencil.
I remember. One of my homies, we went to a graduation at the Bojangles Arena, and he had just came back. Like, this is like over the summer, and he's so uneasy. And I'm like, what's wrong with you, bro? You all right? He's like, bro, I'm going to keep it 100 with you. He's like, I talk openly about my shit. He's like, I don't like being around all these people. Mm-hmm. All these loud noises starting to freak me out. I'm about to go outside and smoke a cigarette. I'm like, are you doing anything about it? He was like, nah, but he kept, you know, I'm just like, that shit's got to be rough. But the fact that he was openly talking about it was a good sign to me, because before, people come back and be like, nah, I'm all right, self-medicate. Which I think a lot of people self-medicate. Even just growing up in the hood. Like, we've seen so much shit growing up in the hood that you kind of start to become numb to so much shit. Like, even emotions, feelings, which can affect your love life, your relationship with your parents. I mean, PTSD, because, you know, it's only a lot of times people just associate it to war. But shit, sometimes growing up in the hood feels like you're in a war.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fighting was very natural. So when people would, like...
Yeah. It's sci-fi right here.
I just wanted to make one point. Because, like, I grew up in the hood where fighting was just a natural thing. So going to college and expecting fights or trying to engage in fights, people were looking at me like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, that's how we communicated at one point. So
it's just the norm. Like, it was a normal thing. But then you get into, like, a regular, like, you go to college, you go to work, and...
Let's square up.
I remember being an undergrad. They're like, gangsters don't come to college. What are y'all doing out here fighting? You know what I mean? Like, you came here to learn. Why are you sending all this money to be out there, you know, just scrapping? But, yeah.
But like you said, it's your upbringing. Like, it makes you who you are in a sense. Like, it affects everything, even in your adulthood.
And I think something I was listening to, something on YouTube, I can't remember, but it was a pastor talking about, or anybody, it's not a pastor. Sometimes it can be a counselor, it can be a pastor, it can be anybody that kind of knows people engagement, people interactions. But this particular person was talking about, we learn how to problem solve by looking at how our parents have done it. You know what I mean? So that's why it's important to ask the questions, whether it be a spouse.
That's 100% true.
And like, not too much your friends. You can be like, how your mama and daddy argue? Okay, let's argue like that. But especially in those intimate relationships, because sometimes depending on what kind of family you come from, parents might not argue in front of the kids. So now you're like, he always walks away. Yeah. So, but you knew there had to be some type of disagreement, but where did they do it and what did that look like? So depending on what it looks like, they're like, yo, every time I have an issue, he walks away or she walks away. They don't know how to argue. That's how they seen their parents argue. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or when it's like really heightened. For the record, my mom and dad were scrappers. You know what I mean? So that's the history. Like, oh, yeah, girl, I remember when I threw that lady under the fence. You know what I mean? And they're like, your dad used to get paid to knock people out in the bar. So I'm like, okay, so then you have that. That's one of those things that I was talking about when we're taught things or things are instilled in us as kids. So then you're like, okay. And I remember having my first fight. I was like telling my mom and like, it was like almost like a round of an applause. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because that was the culture. I have very loving, sweet, compassionate parents. Mm-hmm. But that don't change the fact that they was hood niggas too.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they was not backing down from any action. But even that part, and that goes on to a major, major, major thing that we're learned as, or that I learned as a family therapist, mm-hmm. is like that idea of family loyalty. Like we always hear the word loyalty thrown around so loosely, right?
Yeah.
So family loyalty, when you look at it, you also have to think of all the behaviors that you pick up to be like your family members. You know what I mean? So it's like, okay, if I have a dad that's a scrapper, okay, let me scrap. So I know that, like, I'm like my dad. If you have a parent, let's say, that does drugs or drinks or does things like that, how do I identify or know that I'm this person, you know what I mean? Whether it be like a Jones, or how do I know I'm a Jones? It's not my last name, but I'm just saying, I'm a Jones because I fight, or you know what? I can drink just like my daddy. You know what I mean?
So yeah, I hear that a lot.
Yeah. So people start to identify, with their family lineage or their family connection or having that loyalty. Some of those behaviors are not good behaviors to, you know what I mean, inherit.
But it's just attached to your jacket just because of your last name, basically.
Absolutely. So then again, when do you undo that? When do you change the dynamics and know, like, I can be loving and be a Jenkins, not have to be an alcoholic to be a Jenkins, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I think, like, changing that narrative is important as well.
Mm. Yeah, see, like, my parents, they never screamed and shouted in the house. And if they did have, a disagreement, they would just talk like normal. So that's how I am. Like, if I go through anything with any of the homies, I want to discuss it. Like, if I have an issue with you, let's discuss it and see what we could do about it. And if we can move on, we can move on. If not, it is what it is. But with the homies, we could scream, curse, like with my cousins and stuff.
Right.
My sisters, we'll say whatever we want, scream, shout, curse each other out, get it off the table, and then we just go back to being normal. Right. So I could do both, really. But one thing with me, I don't hold, like, grudges as long as we can speak it out. You know what I mean? But
how do you deal with people that are avoiders?
Because I hate that shit so much. Like, I hate that. Like, if I have an issue with you and you don't want to tell you, like, yo, I don't want to talk about it. That shit drives me. That's when I blow up. I'm like, what you mean you don't want to talk? And nigga, we adults. Like, you have an issue, put it on the table. Right. And I've dealt with, you know, especially when you're dealing with a woman and then she don't want to speak shit out. She's like, I talk about it. Because a lot of times what happens with people who avoid problems is, like, sometimes you'll be over, like, let's just say you're mad right now, but like 30 to 45 minutes or even later on the next day, you're not mad about it. And you try to bring it up like, yo, what happened yesterday? Like, how'd you say, I'm not even worried about that shit anymore. Let's just move on. And then you never resolve the issue because you never spoke about it. And then it resurfaces again.
Right.
Because I don't know. I'm always like my father was heavy on it. Like, communicate with anybody you really care about. Just communicate.
But it's important. Communicate about your communication style. Right?
Wait, go in. What you mean?
So communicate about your communication style. You're a talker. If you have a partner that is not a communicator, that's when you need to sit them down and be like, listen, this is how I function. This is how I'm productive. This is how I, you know, have ease in my heart or in my spirit with something is by talking it out. So I know this is not what you're used to. And I can, you know, I want to acknowledge that. But for it to be healthy, this is how I XYZ, right? Yeah. Because then it goes into now you become frustrated because it's like, what? I wanted to talk about this a day ago.
Exactly.
Now you ain't really addressing it. And a month later, you're talking about how I didn't take the chicken out the freezer. And then
what the fuck you talking about? What chicken?
Right, yeah. So I think it's very important. How do you function? How are you most productive? You know what I mean? And I think that's like that's a major and extreme way to show love and compassion to your partner. This is and having that discussion and letting them meet you where you're at. You know what I mean? I think that's really shows how they show up for you. Like, I know that I don't want to talk about it, but I know this is what's going to be productive for us. So let's process it. But then also, like, hey, I know you don't like to talk about things in a moment. Can we get back to this in 30 minutes just to go through it? That way you're honoring both of y'all's style.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And my father was like straightforward. Like, I don't like to be sugarcoated. Like, if you're going to tell me something, tell me exactly what it is. Because I just really be wanting to know. I hate when people sugarcoat shit with me. Like, if I'm doing something wrong, say, hey, this A, B, and C is what I don't like.
Right.
You know what I mean? D, that's what I do. Like, that's how my father was straightforward. If you're doing something, he's going to check you on exactly what you're doing. There's no, like, gray area with my dad. It's black and white.
Right.
And my mom the same way. Like, they're straight Africans. Like, they really are straightforward. There's no... Because to me, and that's how I am to this day, even with my friends, my loved ones, I'm like, I'm going to just tell you exactly what it is. I'm not trying to hurt your feelings, but that way, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it is important. You're right. I like what you said about that. Like, communicate how you want to communicate.
Yep. Communicate your communication style.
Do you remember the name of that book that you were talking about earlier?
Alrighty. So I do have the name of it. Uh-huh. The book related to trauma and family trauma is called It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. And it's by Mark Wolin, W-O-L-Y-N-N. So I think that's a good resource to have if you are trying to learn how to repair and resolve those traumas.
Mm-hmm. Now, like, this is my last question, is do you think therapy is just for people who are going through something or went through something, or could it just be beneficial to the average person? Because sometimes, you know, you might not know that you're going through something, and then...
It's almost like, if for people who are religious, it's almost like you always pray mm-hmm. when you're into some stuff. You know what I mean? But the use of therapy, it's a tool. So kind of to tie it all together again, related to medication and coping skills and therapy, it's just an added tool. So if you have it set in place, mm-hmm. Definitely utilize it. But at the same time, it the goal of therapy is to graduate from therapy. As a therapist, I don't want to see you. No therapist wants to see you for years on end, because that shows that there's no growth. And that's when we have to resource out and kind of really refer you to other programs and systems and support. But the primary goal of therapy is to graduate with anything, right. To learn those skills, to take away what you need to do, and then practice it on your own. Mm-hmm. If you need to return, come on back. You right. know what I mean? But definitely while you're in there, again, being honest, upfront, fixing those things that need to be fixed.
Yeah.
But then also taking away those tools to be able to independently mm-hmm. Practice and you know, feel good about yourself while you're by yourself. A therapist is never with a client 7 days a week. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's like you have to learn some type of skills. So I think that, no, if you are feeling good about yourself, sometimes you might not need a therapist. You might need a life coach. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what may help you get aligned with some of the goals and how to be productive. But the therapeutic process, politically wise, when in therapy, for insurance, we'll go back to the All About the Benjamins. You have to have a diagnosis sometimes for insurance to reimburse. So what does that look like? You know?
Right.
So I think that it's a bigger picture. But as far as therapy and the therapeutic process as a whole, it is a process that ideally you want to graduate from. Learn your tools, take them away, practice them independently, then come back when you need us.
Thank you so much for coming through. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for having me. And you can reach me. I'm launching my counseling page to provide some positive affirmations, some feedback. Mm-hmm. It's going to be called The T-H-E-E Cookie Jar _. So on that page, I'll be providing some, you know, just some good stuff, some jewels to drop. Yeah. And it just kind of goes the cookie jar. Take as much as you want.
Whenever you get that situation, just remind me, and I'll keep plugging it in here whenever you want.
Thank you so much.
No doubt. And we definitely want you to come back and talk some more, all right?
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Meds, Drinks, and Chill. We signing out. Peace. Yeah, thank you for listening. Make sure y'all follow us on Instagram, Meds, Drinks, and Chill.